This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming from Nipaluna, Hobart. There are encouraging signs the latest COVID wave is easing. Yesterday, there were just over 10,000 cases and the number of patients in hospitals also falling. The drop in numbers comes as another layer of health restrictions is peeled back. From tomorrow, the mandatory 7-day isolation period is dropping to 5. It's aimed at helping to ease staff shortages, but not everyone's convinced it's the right thing to do, as Matt Bamford reports.
At the peak of the pandemic, Western Sydney was a ghost town. But walking through Parramatta CBD today, it's easy to forget the months of successive lockdowns.
Earlier in the morning, they had this workout going on, so there was very loud music playing. The entire place was buzzing. A lot of people stood by to look. When I was on my way to class as well, I was like, this feels more like a club vibe rather than a uni vibe, so what's going on?
That's Maliha Bhaktava. The university student spent weeks at home while COVID spread.
I feel like, yeah, no matter where you were in the world, the lockdown was really hard, like with job losses, people getting infected with COVID.
It took a toll on her mental health.
I think as like humans, we are social beings. It's not just about going out with friends. It's going to uni face to face, going to work, or just like hanging out by yourself or with your friends. And I think a lot of the people did suffer.
From tomorrow, anyone who catches COVID will only have to isolate for 5 days instead of 7, as long as you have no symptoms and don't work in high-risk settings like disability and aged care. It's small relief for Rana Issa, who runs a tailor shop in Parramatta's main shopping centre and has been struggling with staff shortages.
It's better, yeah, I think it's better. Because some people, when they get corona, 2 days, 3 days, they get okay, you know. Better to come to work.
And while there are more people on the streets, Rana Issa says there's a long way to go before her business bounces back.
I'm not sure. I wish getting better. I wish to keep, you know, to keep going with the business. Nobody likes to close the shop.
People aren't spending as much.
No, they're not spending.
Dr. Karen Price from the Royal Australian College of GPs says while case numbers are dropping, COVID remains a risk.
We are looking around the world and seeing that those isolation times are coming down. But I would say to people that, you know, it is a very good public health measure to stay home if you're still feeling unwell, to wear a mask and to protect vulnerable people and to continue with, you know, what we would call good infection control measures, including only going outside in well-ventilated spaces.
After being under immense pressure, she says the strain on GPs has slightly eased.
In some cases, many of the respiratory clinics and vaccination clinics are not quite as busy as they used to be, which is good, but we've still got a heavy burden of people with mental health and chronic conditions which need catching up on, and certainly a population still in high need of healthcare services.
And in another change from tomorrow, states and territory health departments are dumping the daily COVID case number reports, switching to weekly updates instead.
Bamford, reporting there. Australians are being warned to brace for tougher economic times ahead, with next month's federal budget unlikely to provide much in the way of handouts to deal with the surging cost of living. While yesterday's official growth figures show a strong economy, that's expected to fade as runaway inflation and hefty interest rate rises eat into household budgets. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, those GDP numbers blew past most forecasts and should be seen as good news, but the Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers' response to them was grim.
Well, that's right, Sabra. Every economic silver lining has a cloud, it seems, and Jim Chalmers is carefully managing expectations about what lies ahead. The booming tax revenue from commodity exports won't be the only stopgap, that his first budget on October 25 won't be providing handouts beyond those to hardest-hit households, with surging mortgage repayments and bill shock from energy and basic groceries. So things like relief for medicines and childcare. Now, this is the prelude to budget repair, something that neither major party said much about in the lead-up to the election. But with $1 trillion of debt, much of it built up during the pandemic, and deficits as far as the eye can see, budget repair now has to get underway. But expect to hear about sensible and strategic reforms to increase the tax take and to boost productivity rather than budget austerity.
Just how careful does Jim Chalmers have to be in crafting the budget, given high inflation's not disappearing anytime soon?
Well, inflation is the biggest threat, and it's eating into the purchasing power of households and businesses, given that wages aren't keeping up. Inflation is currently at 6.1%, but it will touch 8% by the end of the year. Even though inflation might head lower by mid-next year, the biggest risk is that any major handouts in the budget or cash relief to households would only fuel inflation with more cash floating around in the economy. We've seen this in the United States, where massive stimulus from Joe Biden in the lead-up to midterm elections in November has taken inflation to 40-year highs, forcing the US Federal Reserve to deliver more aggressive interest rate hikes. Jim Chalmers will be wanting to avoid that here in Australia.
And we'll hear from Australia's Reserve Bank Governor later today. Can we expect any sign that interest rate rises might ease off?
Well, Philip Lowe will be addressing the Anika Foundation in Sydney. Not surprisingly, the theme will be inflation and monetary policy. That's after Tuesday's half a percentage point rise to 2.35%. Expectations are that the RBA is now waiting to see the impact of those rate hikes, given that there's a three-month lag. It is possible that future rate hikes will be smaller, more traditional rises of a quarter of a percentage point. So economists will be looking for clues on that. Also, there's a review underway into the RBA and a lot of attention on whether Mr. Lowe will be criticised. Also, last year's signal that the cash rate would stay low until 2024, and what responsibility Philip Lowe takes for guidance that turned out to be wrong and possibly encouraged borrowers to take on too much debt.
Peter Ryan there. A mystery foundation set up just over a year ago by a businessman with connections to the Governor-General, David Hurley, has had its federal funding scrapped. The Australian Future Leaders Foundation was granted $18 million in the Morrison government's final budget. For more on this, I spoke earlier with political reporter Stephanie Boris. Stephanie, take us through what we know about this Leadership Foundation.
Well, the foundation was established in April of last year. It has a couple of directors, but that appears to be it. There's no staff, no website and no programs, as in it hasn't run any leadership workshops or events. But despite that, the former coalition government granted the foundation millions of dollars. The details were outlined in this year's March budget. So it was $18 million would be provided over 5 years, and then $4 million per year ongoing. The budget papers stated that this money would help pay for a program that would develop mid-career leaders in both the government and the non-government sector.
And as mentioned, the foundation was granted $18 million in the budget, but did any of that money actually go to the foundation?
Well, questions were raised earlier this year about how and why this money was promised, given it didn't have to go through a grants process. And while it didn't go through a grants process, it did have the backing of an influential figure. The foundation, from day one, had the support of Governor-General David Hurley. Promotional brochures, for example, seen by the ABC, claim vice-regal and government endorsement of the program, which was actually called the Governor-General's Australian Future Leaders Program. An event for the foundation was even held at the Governor-General's house in Sydney, and he is in fact the inaugural patron of the foundation. Earlier this year, a spokesperson for the Governor-General confirmed there had been several conversations between him and Mr. Morrison about the foundation dating back to 2020, but the Governor-General's office insisted that it had no involvement in government funding decisions. So in terms of money being handed out, while it was promised in that March budget, no cash has been handed over. And now the current government's going through what it's calling a waste audit process. And this is in the lead up to the October budget. The government's trying to find savings, and it's determined that this foundation will no longer be receiving any cash. So the foundation that was set up just last year that had been promised millions and millions of dollars will no longer be getting any of that money.
Stephanie Boris there. Large parts of the United States have been enduring severe drought. It's having some unexpected consequences. The desert city of Las Vegas has emerged as an unlikely leader in water conservation. Even its beloved golf courses are being targeted as efforts to save the precious resource are boosted. North America correspondent Barbara Miller prepared this report from Las Vegas.
So what I'm doing right now is I'm looking for any kind of water waste violation that's occurring in this neighborhood.
Day and night, water cops like Cameron Donnarumma patrol Las Vegas suburbs.
Waterways investigator 8776 today is...
Rule breakers face a warning and then increasing fines.
6:58 a.m. Spray and flow is occurring at this property. The water is running off the property and heading down the street.
The water cops are just one plank of an extensive water savings program in the city, which has become a perhaps surprising leader in conservation.
Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas!
Grass of the kind you smoke is legal here.
Vegas, baby!
But not in your front garden. New properties are prohibited from laying turf, and there are cash incentives for ripping up existing greenery, including on the city's beloved golf courses. Corey Enos from the Southern Nevada Water Authority says it's a win-win for the clubs.
There used to be wall-to-wall grass from over here where we are to back in front of the houses. But the golf courses found that there are areas where people don't play the balls necessarily. And so they were able to remove grass, save themselves money, and save the community water at the same time.
The reason for the strict water measures? The vanishing Colorado River. Overallocation of the water, a mega drought, and climate change are all taking a toll. Levels on the waterway are falling dramatically, including on the Lake Mead Reservoir at Hoover Dam, from where Vegas draws 90% of its water. All along the banks where once the water reached, an eerie white bathtub ring now serves as a barometer of the escalating crisis.
Yes. The water was up there by the white. See where it turns brown?
The U.S. government has triggered unprecedented water cuts in several Colorado Basin states this year, with more on the cards.
We're standing on a cliff and our toes are dangling over the cliff. And can we find our balance and come up with pragmatic solutions?
Former Vegas Water Chief Pat Mulroy says the stakes are as high as they get if further cuts can't be agreed to.
What's at stake if there's no agreement is not just the future of Las Vegas. You can take this entire region and you can shut it down.
A gamble even Vegas can't afford.
Viva! Viva Las Vegas!
This is Barbara Miller in Las Vegas reporting for AM.
And you can watch Barbara's report, The Vanishing River, on Foreign Correspondent, 8 o'clock tonight on ABC TV. As any parent who has a premature or sick newborn baby knows, it can be a dreadful time and you can feel pretty helpless. But a program's trying to change that by encouraging mums and dads to read books to their babies in neonatal intensive care units. Annie Guest prepared this report.
I don't care, said the cat. You're a frog, so you must sit on a log.
At the neonatal intensive care unit at Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital, a father reads to his tiny baby.
I wouldn't mind sitting on a chair. Hares sit on chairs, said the cat.
Surrounded by tubes, machines and lights, some babies are on ventilators as they lie in enclosed cribs, their parents on the other side of the glass.
What about a surface, said the cat?
This is an experience familiar to Matt and Jessica Balkowski, whose daughter Lara spent 98 days in the neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, 3 years ago. And then it happened again.
And this is little Cooper. Cooper was born in February at 26 weeks and spent 104 days in the NICU. So quite an extensive time in the NICU for both of our kids.
The stress and uncertainty was compounded by feeling helpless.
One of the biggest challenges that I found as a dad in the NICU, that I didn't feel like I had a role to play. I had nothing that I could contribute.
Until one day when a nurse suggested he read children's stories through the glass to his delicate baby.
So she gave me a book and she gave me a log and I started reading. It gave myself some purpose. It gave me something to actually go in there and really focus on and know that that was mine and I could own that. I read for nearly 100 hours while I was in the NICU with Lara. I didn't keep a log with Cooper, but I still read to him every day that I was in there for at least 20 minutes.
The log is being used as part of a readathon involving neonatal intensive care units around the world, supported by a charity for premature babies called Life's Little Treasures. Its spokesperson is Karen Peters.
It's amazing to see its growth. We started it 4 years ago, and this year we have 41 hospitals in Australia and 14 internationally, with hospitals participating from Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, Portugal, Scotland, UK and the USA.
Apart from helping with brain development, it's thought reading is soothing for a baby hearing alarms, phones and doorbells in the ICU. The readathon was originally the brainchild of a nurse at Westmead Children's Hospital, and it's applauded by her colleague, clinical nurse consultant Nadine Griffiths.
But what we also know from research in America is that babies admitted directly to a NICU compared to babies admitted to a postnatal ward in a less than 24-hour period experience 14,000 words less than a baby who's with their family in a postnatal ward. And we know for infants greater than 32 weeks gestation, every increase in 100 words supports their longer-term developmental outcomes at 18 months and 2 years of age.
She says there's also research showing parents' confidence increased when they were reading to their babies in the NICU.
Annie Guest reporting. Tasmania is an Aussie rules football heartland. For decades, it's been pushing for its own slice of the, well, almost national game. Now, a decision on whether the AFL will issue a 19th licence to the island state is close, and many say it's now or never. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
It's the Roos and the Crows from Bellerive Oval in Hobart. AFL action for grandstand AFL Chris.
Tasmania's produced its share of AFL stars. But without a local team, the only chance for fans to get a game is to watch visiting interstate sides.
Easy as you like for Taylor Walker. First goal of the afternoon to the Crows. 1-1.
The state spent millions over the years hosting matches for Hawthorn and North Melbourne. But it's been denied its own team for more than 30 years.
You look at the talent that we've had in the past few years and the talent that we have now, there's no reason why we shouldn't have one. We've got enough talent here. We've got enough supporters.
Abby Green is a former AFLW player for Collingwood and North Melbourne, who now coaches in Launceston. She says the lack of a pathway to an AFL team is putting Tasmanian players off the game.
You want to see people aspiring to be the best they possibly can. But yeah, there has been a lot of people that have turned down opportunities because of, yeah, having to relocate and not having that Tasmanian presence.
The Tasmanian government's bid is worth $150 million over a decade, and the AFL's made it clear the decision is contingent on a new stadium in Hobart. The Premier says Macquarie Point is a potential site and that a 23,000-seat stadium would cost the state government about $375 million. Former player Scott Wade, who was the boss of AFL Tasmania for 16 years, says the case for a team stacks up.
Tasmania has deserved a team for a long, long time, so I don't think there's any doubt that Tasmania deserves a team. There's been a belief that economically Tasmania might not be able to afford that, and I think the most recent AFL task force put the economics to bed. There's been a belief within the AFL system that Tasmania can't sort out the north-south issue, and I think that's just an excuse.
And the former Hawthorn player believes the sport's standing will be diminished if the licence bid fails.
What would worry most people that know anything about Tasmanian football are worried about the development of the game if the answer this time is no.
Throw in, but the siren has gone, so that's the end of the second term. We're at halftime here at Bellerive Oval.
Opinion on the streets of Hobart is divided.
Do you think Tasmania should have its own AFL team?
No, I don't think we've got the population to support it. Keep bringing the others down.
Definitely.
Why do you think so?
Because all other states has their own, and Tassie is like the only one left out, so that's not fair.
AFL is pretty big in Tassie, so why not?
AFL boss Gillon McLachlan hinted earlier this week a final call is still a little while off.
We're optimistic of reaching some agreement with the Tasmanian government, and we will then go to our presidents and their boards and clubs in the coming weeks.
But this could be Tasmania's last chance to get a licence.
A big win in Hobart for the Crows.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi,
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Last week, there was a dramatic finale in the case that captivated the nation when Chris Dawson was found guilty of murdering his wife, Lynn. Today, Australian Story producer Wendy Page on her long-lasting connection to Lynn's family and why their battle isn't over yet. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.